Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Scott Tobias. Scott is a longtime film critic, been reading him for many, many years. He just launched a Substack with Keith Phipps, which we'll talk about in a minute. It's called The Reveal, but you can find that. Go check that out. I'll have a link to it in the email here. Sign up for it. It's going to be good. But also, he does the Next Picture Show podcast. He does he was at the Dissolve and previous to that at the AV Club. We're going to talk about this a little bit too, I hope. And also freelances for the New York Times and the Guardian, all sorts of places. Scott, one of the best film critics in the biz, and has kind of seen a lot of the changes in the business over the course of the last 25 years or so, which is what I wanted to bring him on here to talk about today. So thank you for joining me, Scott. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah, I've survived somehow. You know, 23 years of doing this.
It's not easy. I mean, you know, so this, like I said, this is a show about the business of Hollywood mostly, but the business of film criticism is also kind of in rapid flux. And, you know, it's never been an easy business to make a living in. The number of people who can be paid to write about movies at any given time at any point in history is never going to be super high. But it is even harder now, I would say, with the decline of the daily papers and the decline of monthly magazines, decline of weekly magazines. Everything seems to be in decline, with the exception of Substack, which seems to be very, very much emergent or resurgent or whatever you want to call it right now. So let's talk a little bit, before we get to The Reveal, let's talk a little bit about your history working for the AV Club and then going to start The Dissolve and how that all came about. What was the AV Club's deal back in the day?
Okay, so how I came on with the AV Club was very early in the beginning. I met Keith Phipps while I was in grad school at the University of Miami. We happened to both go to a junket, our first junket for both of us in New York, for Scream 2 and Good Will Hunting. And we just happened to sit next to each other. We got along really well. We talked all weekend. You know, at that point, Keith was part of a skeleton crew. I mean, the Onion was only in print in two cities at that point, Madison and Milwaukee. But they were just about to expand to Chicago in print. And so there is going to need to be an expansion of coverage in the section. And so I started freelancing for them and did so for about a year and a half while I was working on my master's in cinema studies. And then they brought me down to Chicago in 1999. And at that point, it was, you know, the AV Club and the Onion, they're all about sort of slow expansion into cities, you know, like the print edition. The print edition really was the big driver in terms of money. Obviously things evolved from there.
Right. Yeah, so. That's interesting. I mean, I don't believe I ever lived in a city that had the print edition. So I often don't think about the print edition of The Onion. But I mean, I assume it was the actual money-making face of the enterprise, since websites aren't.
Yeah, it was robust. It was robust, and it really changed. I mean, we had to think about different things with the AV Club. It allowed us to kind of be what we were because we didn't have to worry about page views. Nobody was looking at page views. At that point, we weren't even we were publishing weekly on the internet, yeah. You know, in black and white even. Yeah. I mean, it was just a reflection purely of what we were publishing in the print edition. I mean, that's what it was. That's what we were doing. So obviously, again, things evolved and we evolved with it. But print was definitely what was important. And all of those print ads, I mean, that's real money. You know, that's not things get a little bit murkier when you get into to digital. And, you know, obviously that's way less lucrative and shadier and kind of, you know, that's when things get tough.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I started reading you at the AV Club. This is, you know, on the internet, probably after it was black and white. It was probably color at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the AV Club was a really interesting place. I mean, it was like, it was a combination, both a great place for long form, interesting, critical essays, but then also it was a real hub for the for, you know, the burgeoning TV recap market, the place where you would go to like kind of hang out with people and talk about what you watched the night before, or the week before. What was that evolution like?
I mean, we didn't have a TV section at all. We didn't do TV at all for quite a while. So just adding TV was big. Yeah. And then when we started recapping after that, the way things used to be, I mean, the AV Club would not have become what the AV Club became if it started now, you know, because we didn't have to worry about page views, and because we didn't know what who was seeing what, you know, article at all times, and mostly because the Onion itself was really the driver. I mean, we were just kind of the back section, right? So basically, yeah. So we could just do whatever we wanted. If we wanted to run to have a 5,000 word interview with Harlan Ellison be like our only feature that week, we could do it. It wouldn't matter. And so that we kind of developed a sensibility that way, and it became a very writer driven, obsession driven enterprise. And so, you know, we would cover the waterfront in terms of what was coming out, but we also, our writers had the opportunity to kind of like express whatever odd obsession they had. And that kind of attracts a certain type of reader. You can kind of really cultivate an audience and really cultivate a community that way. And now it's much harder because everyone's kind of doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say that? When you say everybody's doing the same thing,
because they're incentivized to do so. I mean, they're incentivized to kind of flood the zone on certain big things that everybody is seeing and experiencing. The monoculture, I guess.
Sure.
And they're not as inclined to, you know, to celebrate some nichier thing that you know some corner, some sliver of the populace feels very excited about, but doesn't really apply to anyone else. So it is entirely a numbers driven thing. You just kind of like, you really just, once you know where everybody's going, you just want to kind of ring that bell over and over and over again. And so what you end up losing is a more balanced kind of suite of features, I think. And that's a hard thing to fight against. It's something we fought against as well as we could with the Dissolve. Is just kind of like we were in the game long enough to where we knew which features were going to be, you know, more popular and well read, and then we'd run those, and then we'd run a feature that we wanted to run that we knew wouldn't do as well. That was our idea of editorial balance, but that idea is very outdated. I mean, now it's really no one does the stuff nobody wants to read. I mean, nobody does like the second feature about Krzysztof Kieslowski's like, you know, pre Double Life of Verne films, you know, it doesn't do it anymore.
This is the critics' version of the the so-called directors, one for them, one for us method, right? Like the idea that you can make something that is both popular and then something for yourself. So let's talk a little bit about the move from the AV Club to the Dissolve, because I think that this is, the Dissolve is looked upon by folks of my generation a few years on either side as like the golden age of internet film writing. This was like this was the good times, as some character might say. What was that? What instigated that move, and how was it to work there and to kind of be in a slightly different ecosystem? It was under Pitchfork, right?
It was, yeah. So it was a pretty dramatic time, I would say. Things were really changing at the AV Club. There were a lot of philosophical differences, I would say, between, you know, the old guard represented by Keith and myself and Tasha Robinson and Nathan Rabin and Genevieve Kosky and others, and then kind of a newer way of thinking about where the AV Club needed to go to be successful. And ultimately Keith lost his job. He was the editor in chief. And so he really kind of thought up this idea of just, you know, why don't we try to do Pitchfork for Film? And he approached Chris Caskey, who was the head of Pitchfork, and Chris Caskey actually had worked in advertising for The Onion back in the day. And he along with Ryan Schreiber, who founded Pitchfork, had taken, you know, again, what was like a very DIY internet enterprise and made it into a very profitable, independent, mm-hmm. you know, online publication, which was, you know, huge. And so that idea that Pitchfork for Film is just such a strong, resonant idea, and they bought it, and so he took it. We all went over there with him, and we brought on Matt Singer and Noel Murray, who of course we worked with forever, and who's my oldest friend probably. We brought him on board, and so it was really this and we were able to design the site from the ground up in a completely idealistic way with minimal, input from management, with the full resources of an extremely good design and development team that made the site look as good as it did and it does. It was just a chance to kind of like, let's just do the best possible thing that we can. And see what happens. And it seemed at the time, on a business front, it felt kind of can't miss, weirdly enough. I never thought that it would fail because the idea was we would do this in a stripped down way. This is an independent publication. We don't have this large corporate succubus that's going to be taking all of our money and manipulating things in a way that we don't like. We were given we were promised a couple of years of runway in which we would not even have to sell an advertisement. It was just about like making something good, doing this long term. And because Pitchfork was such a frugal company and had succeeded as an independent company, the thought was like we could add on to that and we'd be fine. And we were in a way, we did what we wanted to do. I think mm-hmm. the 2 years that we existed, I was extremely proud of the site, of course, but on a business level, the way digital media and digital advertising was headed, it was structurally impossible for us to succeed. It was structurally impossible for Pitchfork itself to continue to succeed, which is why Pitchfork is a Condé Nast company now and not an independent enterprise, because all of that advertising money was being sucked up, or what advertising money there was being sucked up by major, digital enterprises like Vox and Vice and places that just had a much bigger gravitational pull. And so, and when it came time to sell the company, we were just nothing but red ink on the ledger, and that was it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's too bad. Cause, like you said, it was a great 2 years, and interesting, but it is indicative also of just the kind of the real difficulty and the real impossibility of doing a site like this and having it be interesting, also B, not be lowest common denominator, and C, also not just be festooned by ads. I go to so many sites now that I close out on, because I click a link and I get there and there's four different pop-ups and five different banner ads that load before the story. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, my attention span is done. I don't care enough about the headline that I just clicked off of on Twitter to read this.
I can tell you, we never had a problem being festooned by ads or getting ads. Though Pitchfork was, they're very brand conscious, very important, design is so important to them. They would never allow the shenanigans that you see on other sites. They don't want the reader experience to be horrible, just for the sake of selling more ads. Which again, credit to them. I carry zero bitterness about Pitchfork and the way they handled everything. It was just an unfortunate circumstance. It was kind of certainly heartbreaking to see it go down, but it was it was a great run, and we could at least leave that site behind knowing that we gave our best and that people genuinely liked it. People don't like anything now. So like, if people like your site, you know, maybe like a website. That's a pretty good,
yeah,
pretty good and rare thing.
And the Dissolve is still there, right? If you go to the Dissolve, the site is still.
Yeah, we still have to kind of keep fighting for that, actually, Elizabeth.
Okay.
Sometimes certain things, there's certain like licenses expire and stuff. We kind of have to find whatever connection we have. And we were given a promise the day that was almost the first question I asked, I think, when they pulled the plug. Was like, I didn't want the site to go away.
Right. I mean,
because that happens commonly. That's everybody, and it's just like the idea of like doing 2 years of your best work and you're right, and a lot of your writers doing their best work. And just having it evaporate like that, it's just painful, too painful. So we,
that's not great.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's such a digital media phenomenon. It's just like,
yeah,
you just feel like you're kind of like, you know, shoveling words into the, into the ether sometimes.
Yeah.
You know? And we didn't want that. We wanted it to be preserved if we could. And so far, so good. I mean, one day it won't be probably, but we're still a lot 6 years later.
Yeah. So let's talk about the move to Substack for you. I mean, obviously there's a lot of freelance work in the meantime, you know, since I like, but let's talk a little bit about the reveal, because I think it's really interesting that Substack is making an effort to prioritize actual criticism. I mean, you guys are coming aboard. Ty Burr came before, as we had discussed. I think there are some other names. There was somebody else who you had mentioned that I have now forgotten. Yes. What do you make of the of that effort on their part to kind of?
Well, I mean, I think they're just they want to kind of. I can't speak for what their institutional philosophy is, but it does seem to me that, you know, they want to attract, you know, established writers that can bring on kind of a certain base of support, and they also kind of want to have a nice, diverse, you know, suite of newsletters for people to choose from. You know, I mean, I think we're experiencing kind of a newsletter boom right now, and Substack is kind of at the head of that, and they're being quite aggressive about it. Though I would say, I mean, this was something that we approached them with. We are actually, Keith and I were going to. Your original plan was just to put a newsletter together and try it. In terms of actually, you know, coming to them and actually making an arrangement, being under contract, getting certain amounts of, you know, support, both financially in terms of, and also in terms of design and editing and other things, that came later. But that was a very good, smooth process, and they were very eager, and so it was a good deal for us.
Yeah. Substack is interesting. I mean, we're, you know, full disclosure, if you may be listening to this on iTunes, but the Bulwark Goes to Hollywood is hosted on a Substack platform. But it is interesting to me just how good a sense they seem to have for the pro stuff, which I'm not part of Substack Pro. But from what I hear from people who have done it, they do a very good job of kind of pinpointing just about they understand how much money folks can make, and don't seem to be overselling it to steal them away from pre-existing jobs.
Yeah, no, they don't. I mean, the good thing too is like they have skin in the game now, right? It's like, you know, if we were just to start the thing independently, you know, they would just get a cut of whatever we brought in.
Right.
But here, if they're making a very tangible and sizable investment in us, that means that they have to be kind of active and really in support, and also means reassurance for us. And I think that's important for other kind of pro writers. I mean, I've got a family, I got kids to feed. Right. I can't spend, you know, 20 or 30 hours of my week on something, on the hopes that it's going to get enough subscribers to bring in money. It can't. So this gives you that assurance that you can kind of gives you the runway that you need to kind of establish yourself. And hopefully after a year, which is how long these contracts last, you know, you'll have built up enough of a subscriber base to where you can kind of just, you know, go forward on your own. So that's the idea anyway.
And the nice thing about Substack too is that you, I mean, as opposed to running a big, broad, general website, you can kind of narrowcast for that 1,000 true fans, right? The quote unquote.
That is completely right. This is somehow a pure enterprise than the Dissolve, which I did not think was possible. I mean, there's literally Keith and I can do whatever we want, and this is what we're doing. Like, you know, yeah, we're writing about whatever essays we feel like on, you know, we want to write, we're going to write whatever reason we want to write, we're going to write whatever conversations we feel like we're going to have, we're going to have. It's like there's no one is looking over our shoulders. It is a, you know, and the hope is just you don't need that much. I mean, we need more, but like you need a certain amount of people to make that a sustainable proposition. But it's not it's not an insane number of people. It's just, and so you can find, it's like the opposite of everything I described about digital publications. You don't, it encourages you to have a niche. It encourages individual personalities and sensibilities. And, you know, under the thought that you don't need as many people to follow you, but the people who follow you are going to be really intense about it. And that was kind of how we built the AV Club, of just like, you know, we were very niche-y at the time, and that earned us a very solid baseline of support, and that's all the support we need for something like this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is fascinating. I mean, I think you know, one way that people know you, and I'm gonna apologize ahead of time for bringing this up as being the you know, anti Shrek guy, which is so weird because, you know, you've had a whole career based on like loving things. Yeah. And there's this one essay in The Guardian that you write on what was it, the 20th anniversary of Shrek that kind of went viral and people were very mad about it.
Sure.
But it is a weird indictment of the internet ecosystem, right?
Yeah, I mean, while I was kind of known as the anti-Birdman person before, so it's always kind of the ones that stand out, the anomalous things that kind of get you the attention. Mm-hmm. Because of course, you know, I write for Shrek. It's like, you know, I write anniversary pieces constantly for The Guardian.
Right.
I'm on that beat. In fact, I've got ones coming up on The French Connection and in Mulholland Drive. And you know, spoiler alert, I'm going to say nice things about both of those movies. But like, I don't know. Actually, I missed it. What was the other question again?
What is it about the internet media ecosystem, right? That like kind of that turns hate into more, you know, easily monetized or just shareable than appreciation.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I didn't. On my end, on that particular piece, it was just like, it was very banal in the sense that, because I do write these anniversary pieces, and I get, it's like a one line pitch I get from my editor, Ben Lee. It's like, you know, it's Shrek at 20 ? And I'll say, and I wrote back, with the proviso, I don't like the film very much. Is that okay? And that, there it is. The essay got written and then it got posted and it got shared. I mean, it was unusual, I think, you know, when an anniversary hits, particularly an anniversary of a film that large, you expect, you know, these kind of glowing retrospective pieces, maybe get some talks with the original animators, or, you know, I mean, you're kind of getting that perspective. So it's pretty rare to kind of use, you know, an anniversary, which is a time that we are supposed to celebrate these things, as the time to kind of like rain on that parade, you know? So I think it kind of stood out for that reason. But I'm not sure. I mean, the thing was troubling for me was just like the idea of criticism at all being just shocking, like, why, how could you do this, you know, just, you know what I mean, just like people are surprised that you can have an opinion that is negative about something, particularly something that's pretty widely beloved, and it gets really hostile. I got it. It was, you know, I had a lot of fun, honestly, on my end, but it was just an incredible, you know, 2-day long just deluge of hatred sent my way. Fortunately, they didn't include my my like Twitter handle or something on the tweet, or it would have been even worse.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that definitely that will occasionally happen for a Washington Post piece I write, and they include my handle for some random reason, and I'll be like, okay, this is why we don't do that.
Yeah,
social media people. No, but it's I mean, it's interesting, and it does feel like a similar phenomenon that we see in the worlds of fandom, right? Like anytime you write something that is even approaching critical about, you know, an MCU movie or a DC movie or whatever, mm-hmm. there's a certain segment of the population that just gets super upset, that does not handle criticism at all. And I'm curious, I have a theory on this, and it is that we have wrapped our own identities, or some people have wrapped their identities in things not only being entertaining, but also approved of culturally and critically, that it creates a sort of like, it just makes them feel bad as people to have these things criticized in a way they don't like.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a phenomenon that I don't have any good theories. it's so foreign to me. It's like, the weird thing about me is that I actually wanted to be a film critic when I was a teenager. That's all I wanted to do. And the impulse to do it was like, some part of the impulse was to do it was like, I don't have to, is that I can stand against the machine in a way. Like I'm apart from all of this stuff. And I can just, talk about the things I love and I don't love or whatever, and express myself without any kind of, I always felt that was great. And part of that is like taking down, soulless studio movies. Like, the opposite thing where you're kind of like standing or whatever for Netflix or Marvel or something. It's just, I don't get that. Yeah. That impulse is so foreign to me that I haven't even, I can't even grasp it. Probably in the same way that they can't grasp why I would write what I did about Trek.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the fandom question is a long running one. I know lots of people get kind of bent out of shape one way or the other about fans and fandom and all that. But it is interesting that you use the word machinery to describe film criticism. Do you ever run into issues with flax or studios or even filmmakers or whoever who are, let's say, annoyed that you're not writing proper reviews that go on Rotten Tomatoes and, you know, can affect the score one way or the other? Because criticism has been commodified in a very real way, like to the point where it's just distilled down to a single number on a website that's like, this is good, it's fresh, or it's bad, it's rotten. And it's very strange to have kind of lived through this as it happened.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole another ball of wax. I mean, like, the fact that you can read a review from anybody across the country, mostly for free. That was ruinous to film criticism. I mean, when I was coming up, minor cities would have multiple film critics. That's all they do is review films. And here you have, major cities like Chicago, where we've got a couple of full-time critics in the major papers, but they're kind of barely holding on, and minor cities, forget it. It's been this like destructive thing. And it's a weird thing to kind of see. I don't see the aggregators as being responsible for that phenomenon, but it has changed the way that people think about criticism, because if they're going to go to Rotten Tomatoes first, they're just going to see an aggregate score. I mean, that's not really criticism. That's just kind of like figuring out what movie you want to see on a Friday night or something. Just like, oh, I got an 82. I guess I should probably go see that, and maybe if you're looking at some of those quotes and one of them stands out to you, if Stephanie Zakarg didn't like the latest Marvel film, then maybe you can kind of like harass her or something for the day. I mean, like, no. I don't know. I don't love it. I mean, from my perspective, like until really recently, I hadn't reviewed a film, like a proper review of a film, for like a year, you know, because I'd been doing some regular reviews for NPR after the Dissolve went down, and then NPR stopped paying for freelance film reviews, and I've been doing Variety stuff, and then the pandemic affected them as well. And so it's like, oh, so like the one thing that I kind of got in this business for, it went away. And so that's another reason why I'm really excited to kind of have the reveal, is that I just wrote a big review of Titane that we're running this week. And I've got another review coming for the Many Saints of Newark. And it's just like the idea, the option, being able to kind of write a proper review of kind of a large-ish film. I mean, I haven't been doing that for like 6 years.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's nice. It is one of the fun things to get to do, for sure. So what is your publishing schedule actually going to look like at the reveal? Are you and Keith going to kind of trade off? Are you each going to do a couple pieces a week? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's going to be hard out of the gate. The first 3 weeks or so, we're going to have a newsletter a day, which is a pretty fast pace, and not one that is sustainable or even recommended in a way. Typically, newsletters usually run three. You usually get three a week is a typical pace. We might be a little bit above that, because there are two of us. I will say that one thing that we, they wanted us to kind of, Substack kind of wanted us to go all in if we could on this. And that was one thing we said no on, that we had to kind of keep up our other freelance obligations, because, you know, we know from experience that it's like, you know, things can go away. I mean, we could not be, it's possible that the reveal won't succeed. It's possible that Substack itself won't succeed. The New York Times is going to be around for a while. You know, that's not going to go away. Right. So I'm going to like throw that away. I'm not going to do it. But we'll publish at least 3 days a week, hopefully more, and just have a nice mix of essays and reviews and, you know, think pieces and lists and kind of conversations, dialogues, I guess, between Keith and myself, and you know, deal with films old and new too, just like we did with the AV Club and the Dissolve. So it'll be a nice mix of, like, you know, classic films or older films and new stuff.
Yeah, no, it's great to see. I like I said, I'm you know, I've got a whole wall of critical collections that I, you know, have picked up at used library sales over the years. And it's very nice to see, you know, a site take a chance on actual voices and doing, you know, actual real criticism, as opposed to, you know, kind of a lot of what we get on the internet now.
It's incredible. And I'll tell you, like, one thing about Substack, it's like, you know, the idea of readers paying you directly for your work. I mean, that is a very powerful and very humbling experience for me, because it's like, you know, I draw salary, you know, freelance rates, etc. You know, I'm used to the kind of like the weird flim-flammery of circulation numbers and then digital numbers. And it's like, this is so direct. This is like, you have this many subscribers, they are paying you for this work because they think that you're worth reading. And it's like, it's an enormously powerful feeling. And it's been really great to experience this week.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I'm glad. And things seem to be going well so far in the first week here.
The launch was hugely successful by our estimation. And it's just a matter of, like, you know, we have kind of a idea of where we would want to be to after a year to make this, you know, a long-term proposition. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's a bigger mountain to climb, but, you know, once you, to mix metaphors, I guess, you know, we have a snowball going down the mountain at this point. We have something, a solid start, you know, and now comes kind of the slow build of just kind of earning people's support and you know, continuing to put out work that's as good as we can make it, and trying to find, you know, an audience that's going to want to read it and hopefully pay for it. But so far, so good.
Awesome. Scott, I always like to close these by asking if there's anything I should have asked. Is there something that I have not discussed, we have not talked about from the, like, evolving world of film criticism, or specifically with what you and Keith are doing at the reveal? What should folks know? What do you want folks to know?
Well, one thing that I would say, you know, again, to sort of promote the site and promote what we've been doing for a long time is to try to build a community where conversations are a little bit different and better. You know, I mean, we did sort of famously have a decent comment section in the Dissolve, and that was not by accident. It was about setting a tone that commenters would feel comfortable and would reinforce that tone. And we hope to kind of carry it over to the Reveal and make it a place where people can kind of express their opinions and their enthusiasms and stuff together, you know, and have some kind of a community because the kind of discussions you can have, you know, over social media, you know, Twitter especially, can be really fraught. In addition to not being all that in depth in a lot of cases, and it's like, you know, and also, you know, so this is maybe a chance to kind of build our own little nest here and make it kind of a welcoming place for, you know, like-minded people who really, you know, love movies and want to go deeper into them and want to find other people that share their interests. So that's our hope here. And that's really kind of like at the heart of what we're attempting.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned the comments, and I'm glad that you brought that up because it is interesting that, like, you know, for the longest time, and I think this is still true at most general readership sites, is the rule is don't read the comments, don't read the comments, just don't subject yourself to that. But as you mentioned, the Dissolve was better, and the AV Club I had a reputation for being pretty good, for a while as well. But the weird thing about Twitter, which I love and I'm addicted to, and you know, it is what it is. But like the weird thing about Twitter was that it really did bring the comments section to you. It was like this is if you want to have a bunch of people screaming at you. I got a good website for you. It's called Twitter.com. And it the idea of having a nice curated place, or not even curated, just like self-curated people who are there because they want to be there and because they're willing to spend the money to be there. Is very nice.
I mean, it's a different kind of thing because it's just I think you approach it differently. It's not quite as, you know, tribal, I guess, or adversarial. You know, there's a real you just express yourself in a different way. I mean, I'm certainly used to the kind of combat that takes place on Twitter. I mean, my internet experience really started with Usenet, you know, with rec art. It's like rec arts movies, current films, or something like that. I was, you know, that's where kind of I went to war, and I mean, that's just pure aggression there a lot of the time. Though again, you can find little communities there. So I was used to, I'm not as shocked by Twitter as a lot of people are because I'm used to that kind of discourse. But at the same time, the intensity of it is so wearying, you know, I mean, both in a good way. I mean, it's both kind of a constant endorphin rush, but also a stressor. And like, you know, there are other places you can go to settle yourself a little bit and kind of have a different kind of conversation, I guess, and have it be among friends, really, hopefully people who get along and are comfortable, you know, are getting into it and arguing with each other, but not in a way that's disrespectful or overly harsh. So, you know, we're keeping our fingers crossed on that. It's just, that's a matter of time too. I mean, we have our core group that has subscribed. I mean, our people came out in a big way, incredible. And so we already have a really good, thing going with in terms of comments, but as we grow, hopefully that it becomes a real kind of culture that, you know, that builds and grows on its own, even apart from our influence.
Yeah. Scott, thank you very much for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Again, it's thereveal.substack.com. Go check it out. Like I said, I'll link to it in the email in the body of this piece. So you can find it there too. But I have signed up. I'm a member, subscriber, whatever preferred term you guys use.
Subscriber.
And I'm looking forward to seeing more. I'll be back next week with another episode of What Work Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.